Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. I'm Sarah Bankson, Deputy Director of RTP. Today, we're happy to host two experts as they discuss a newly released report from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Modernizing the EPA, a Blueprint for Congress. Darren Baxt is a director of the Center for Energy and Environment and a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Darren also authored the report, and so we're very much looking forward to hearing from him on the recommendations that are outlined. We're also joined by Michael Buschbacher, partner at Boyd & Gray PLLC. Michael has extensive experience in challenging regulatory overreach. He represents an array of clients with a particular focus on energy and environmental matters. Thank you both for being with us today. With that, I'll hand it over to you, Michael.
Well, thank you very much. Darren, this is a fascinating and really ambitious project. So why don't we just start with the kind of dust jacket version of what the project is about and what you and CEI are trying to accomplish by putting this out?
Yeah, so a lot of people were involved in this. It wasn't just me, but we had a lot of people here at CEI and outside the organization providing advice and expertise. And at CEI, we're really focused on reforming the administrative state. That's the big concern, and especially the out of control administrative state. And I think if you think about any agency you'd want to focus on in particular, EPA makes a lot of sense. A majority of the costs of all the regulatory costs in the federal government comes from the EPA. So anywhere 55-60% come from EPA. And that's just, the thing is, the cost by itself doesn't really capture the full scope of the effect that the EPA has on our lives. I mean, the nature of the regulations that we can look at simply from the de facto EV mandate to the regulations like the Clean Power Plan 2.0 that try to change the way we generate electricity have just huge sweeping effects on our lives. So it's really the case. We wanted to do something for Congress to provide specific recommendations on how to address this agency that I think has gone beyond its mission. Regulates like it's the 1970s and not 2025, and actually can kind of like focus on what the core environmental issues without being like an economic planning agency. And I think that's what it's become.
So, you know, you touched on one of the themes that I picked up in the book, which is that EPA has gotten beyond what Congress even originally intended when it passed a lot of these kind of core environmental statutes like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. Why do you think things have gotten to where they are? I mean, it's kind of, if they're going beyond where Congress wanted them to go, it sort of raises this question of why is that? And what are the, what is there that prevents that from happening? Again, I think the book has some interesting ideas about how to make sure there are better checks going forward. But as a broad matter, what are your thoughts on that?
I think some of the statutes themselves are a problem. We haven't like reauthorized these statutes in forever. You know, they just kind of exist, and there's just constant review of standards. And when you have a period of 50 years or however many years, things change over that period of time. And Congress really needs to revisit the situation because the factors of the thought process that went into regulating something in 1980 is just not the same thing as in 2025. And then you combine that with, in many situations throughout the statute, there's no, the statute, I'm talking about the Clean Air Act specifically, may not allow consideration of costs and trade-offs, or if it does so in a fairly weak manner. So then you have an agency that's continuously regulating, trying to get marginal gains, and to get the marginal gains, it's for massive costs, with very little to constrain it. And then you throw in the fact that they can regulate greenhouse gases, which I don't think Congress ever envisioned. And it's greenhouse gas regulation, I don't think was ever envisioned with the Clean Air Act at all. And when you can regulate greenhouse gases, you're in effect being able to regulate the entire economy. That's why it's, you know, such a problem for the EPA to be able to regulate greenhouse gases. And then you combine that with, like, again, no cost limitations as much as there should be. There's a lot of precautionary principle type of language in the statute, the Clean Air Act.
Can you explain what that means?
It's just very risk averse. Just kind of almost, we're just going to assume something is a problem until you prove otherwise. I mean, that's very simplistic, I know, but that's kind of.
So it assumes a dysfunctionality that the market won't solve from the get-go, and then the burden is on those who want to have liberty to do what they like to show why it's okay versus the other way around.
Well, I think as relates to what we're talking about, you know, pollutants, it's just the idea that we're going to assume that it actually causes health and welfare problems unless it can be shown otherwise. And actually, even more than that, I think there was a concern that the EPA wouldn't regulate initially or wasn't regulating fast enough. I don't think that. So the statute, at least the Clean Air Act, kind of almost forces the EPA to regulate in many situations. Mm-hmm. And doesn't really have to consider the harms of doing so. And I think it, maybe in the 1970s, when we're coming out of, you know, the environment is not exactly in great shape back then, at least compared to today. I don't think that today we would say that EPA, we should be concerned about the EPA regulating or not. I think it's pretty obvious they're more than happy to regulate. And the truth is, so long as you give an agency, any agency, broad and sweeping power, they're going to continue to use that and keep expanding their power. And that's the big problem.
So one of the things that you just mentioned, two things. One is the diminishing returns on the regulatory costs. I think of it kind of as a tractor pull as you get closer to baseline levels of whatever it is you're trying to regulate, because there's a little bit of everything everywhere, right? As you get closer to those baseline levels, the amount of work it takes to do that increases. And this kind of pro-regulatory bias. What specific recommendations do you have? We can start with maybe under the Clean Air Act for dialing that back to something more reasonable and something that takes costs into account. You have specific recommendations, I think, on National Ambient Air Quality Standards, the so-called NAAQS. And so maybe you can speak about that or any other ideas that you have.
Yeah, that'd be great. So on NAAQS, again, it's marginal benefits, marginal gains with huge costs. It just seems like the goalposts are constantly being moved. There's, as folks know, it's a 5-year review process, and the agency can make the standards stricter or not over the 5 years, and they determine whether or not it's appropriate. But we constantly get this moving of the goalposts. Now, there is no cost consideration in setting the standards. Now, that's what apparently the law says, or that's what it's been interpreted to mean. I would say that it's a fallacy. I would say that I think when you consider when the administrator, I think there's this idea that there's some objective answer as to how you set the standard for ozone. You know, it's got to be 70 parts per billion or whatever it might be, or PM 2.5, as if there's just like an objective scientific answer to what the number should be. But risk considerations themselves are subjective. The risk tolerance is subjective. And that by itself is something that will change depending on who the administrator would be, what the tolerance level is. But furthermore, I think administrators are considering costs. They're just not making it transparent. They might do a cost-benefit analysis, and the agency might show that data, but they don't consider it. They're not allowed to. But the reality is, in practice, there are probably decisions being made where we don't want to make the ozone standard more strict because it will hurt the economy. We've seen that with the Obama administration and the Biden administration when it came to reconsideration, as opposed to the regular review process, the reconsideration of ozone. So I think it's kind of a fallacy to think that costs aren't be part of it anyway. So a recommendation is we need to consider the cost. Let's just be honest about it, make it transparent. So as it relates to the cost component, it's just, let's just be honest and make sure that we don't keep imposing unrealistic requirements on all states to be able to be in attainment for, to meet concentration levels that are just not feasible, especially for individual states where some of the background levels are probably already, you know, high enough so that you really, there's not much to gain. You can't really achieve much more.
So, you know, this is a Federalist Society podcast, so I'm a little slow to point this out, but if you go and read American Trucking versus Whitman, Justice Scalia's opinion in there, and I think this is what you're alluding to, Darren, says you can't consider cost as EPA when you're setting these air quality standards, but then kind of leaves the door open to considering other things, but not really. It's a very strange, the two halves of that opinion are incommensurable. And I think it has left the agency in a position where to follow the sort of first half of that opinion would be to destroy the American economy completely. I mean, if you can't, everything makes a little, every time you speak, you release a little bit of PM2.5. So the notion that, you know, you can't consider anything, I think that's just been a dysfunctionality they've been sort of muddling through. It seems to me quite sensible to have a congressional solution to that.
Right. I mean, when you have like so much like low hanging fruit where it's just easy to kind of, all right, you know, there's so many problems, let's just set the standard at whatever, because we're not really trying to create, we're not creating much pain here. We're hitting a low hanging fruit. There's a lot of opportunity for improvement. So Congress says, we want you to do it. You know, we don't care about maybe those trade-offs early on, but we're so far down the line where we have to start considering these costs and trade-offs. And these decisions on the ambient air quality standards are so significant at this point that it should not be up to any agency, the EPA, or any agency of this type, of these sweeping decisions that have such a huge effect on our lives, the economy, how we live our lives. And one of the recommendations in the book is to have, just to say, great job, EPA, well done. Now Congress can take it from here and states can take it from here. And that really is really kind of what the ideal solution when it comes to NACT is just to simply say, okay, EPA, you make sure there's no backsliding. Maybe we codify the standards in the law. And at that point, EPA, you're kind of, that's your role, but really it's up to the states now to decide for themselves, considering their own interests, whether or not it makes sense to have a stricter standard than the standards that the floor that the federal government has set.
So one thing that's interesting to me is the difference between the NAAQS program and Title IV of the Clean Air Act. Title IV is the has the acid rain program, and no one ever talks about acid rain anymore. And I think the reason for that is that that program worked pretty well, and that kind of seems to have just sort of run its course. And that's a cap and trade system that sets specific goals. Is that one of the kind of options that you think would be a better approach for setting, you know, or looking at ambient air quality when you're talking about particulate matter or ozone or things like that?
Honestly, I haven't thought about that, but I mean, to the extent that we set the goals, I would say that are the standards themselves the goals in some ways? But the problem is, once we have the goal, 5 years later, we've got another goal, even though most of the counties in the country haven't met the original goal. Right. And even, you know, just like, it's like, can we at least let this, the previous standard be implemented and let people actually try to achieve that? But there's no end point. And there needs to be an end point. The goal, I mean, I think by codifying some of the standards or just saying good job, you know, is to say that we've reached certain goals, we're done, now let the states handle it. Or another alternative that's possible if you really want EPA involved is to have them play more of a, okay, they can review it, but let Congress be the one that ultimately makes the final decision on whether or not.
It's kind of a RAINS Act, yeah, a mini RAINS Act for Title I of the Clean Air Act.
Yep. I think that's exactly what it is. It's just an alternative. I prefer first option, door number one, over door number two. I know that door one and door two are going to be tough. There are NAAQS reform bills out there, and they don't do these things, but they kind of keep the EPA involved. But some of the things they do are to extend the review period from 5 years to 10 years to have some consideration of the adverse effects of the setting the standards. But I like to see them be stronger, these provisions. I don't know that just going to 5 to 10 years is really it's fine, but it's not really the ultimate solution. Mm-hmm. You really need to properly consider the adverse effects from setting the standards. You need to be realistic on recognizing the kind of the background levels and what is actually controllable and what can be done. You need to have feasible kind of technology and not try to impose unrealistic technological requirements. I think if we do that, at least it minimizes the problem.
So one area that technology forcing stuff comes up is in Title II. Title II is the mobile source part of the Clean Air Act. And it's one of the quirkiest things in that law because cars move around, it really limits state authority to do anything related to new auto emission regulation. This is in Section 209 of the Clean Air Act. But as you point out in the book, there's one pretty huge exception to that, and that is California alone and among the states can get a so-called waiver of Clean Air Act preemption that allows them to impose their own standards, which they've used to literally ban internal combustion vehicle cars within the next decade, something that Congress is actually considering right now about whether to use the Congressional Review Act to repeal. Those programs don't just affect California, of course. Every other state in the union under actually bizarrely Section 177, which is in the stationary source national air quality standards part of the Clean Air Act, every other state can adopt it. So what are your recommendations for changing this part of the Clean Air Act?
You know, a big theme of the book is kind of respecting states and their ability to kind of address issues. We talked about that with just the NAAQS issue just now. And then the Clean Water Act, a lot of these statutes kind of stress the importance for states to be involved. But I do think that there's something different here when it comes to motor vehicles. Truly interstate market, it's not feasible. You kind of have a bunch of states setting different emission standards. Now, California got this special kind of waiver, unlike other states under Section 209. Because they had some pretty unique air quality issues.
There's a book by John Graham at IU that says that when the Spanish arrived for the first time into what's now LA, they found it was full of smog. There were no cars, but it's the unique weather patterns there that create
weather. I don't know to what it's made topography and elsewhere also. Mm-hmm. But the problem is first of all, there's been all kinds of improvements, though, with air quality in California, just like it has been across the country. Incredible improvements. That's something that's also really important to point out, that it's just a constant myth that our air is somehow dirty or something.
Our air is cleaner than every other country in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think people don't recognize that. I think that there's scare tactics out there. Also, when you see things, I mean, we're going on a little tangent here on this point, but like when you see things about greenhouse gas regulation, they'll show like a power plant, they'll see show smoke or pollution or whatever. And it's amazing how many people think that like greenhouse gas kind of gases dirty the air and it makes it harder to breathe. And it's just, I think it's important for people to understand that's not what greenhouse gases are. But back to the waiver issue. The problem is the waivers are not being used for greenhouse gas emissions. There's nothing unique about a car driving in California versus a car driving in Texas, the effect is going to be the same on California. It doesn't make a difference. So even the logic of the waiver doesn't make any sense as relates to greenhouse gases. Now, we don't, in the book, I don't think it makes sense at all anymore anyway. So the book recommends to get rid of the waiver. It also recommends getting rid of the waiver, which is actually called an authorization for what are called the non-road engines and vehicles, so like trains.
Right.
So, because California can get a waiver on that as well. And, you know, they're trying to electrify trains. It's not just cars. They're trying to kill off a lot of trains as well. So
trains already are electric in the sense that they have, many of them have, the most common technology, right, is diesel generation of electricity on board the actual train, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I talk about non-road engines, it's, you know, everything from lawnmowers to farm equipment to, you know, so our recommendation is to get rid of these waivers. There is legislation, actually, that Senator Lee introduced this year called the Stop CARB Act, and it would get rid of those waivers.
CARB refers to the California
Air, right, California Air Resources. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's good.
So that plus the, like I said, there's this effort right now in Congress to see if they can use the Congressional Review Act to repeal.
And yes, and they absolutely should.
Well, I agree with that, but that's been a project of mine for a long time to see how. We've talked about greenhouse gas emissions some. It probably makes sense to just talk directly about this. I mean, there's an important difference in the regulatory, if you want to deal with carbon dioxide, that's sort of different in kind, I think, from most of the things we think of as pollutants. And the solutions are not local or even national. If you're going to be reducing greenhouse gas emissions, the only metric that matters is net across the globe, right? So what should EPA's role for this kind of thing be? And there are some parts of the Clean Air Act, at least as currently written, that do have some greenhouse gas emission regulation at some level expressly, but most of it has been kind of read into it following the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts versus EPA. So what do you think, what should the regulatory paradigm be, big picture, and what are the specific fixes on the Clean Air Act that you think should happen?
Look, big picture. So the way the book is written, first of all, we try to make it very accessible and provide a lot of context so people can kind of understand why we're recommending what we are, and also the issues. You know, a lot of times papers just kind of throw out recommendations and not really explain why something's a problem. The book really tries to explain that. And then the recommendations kind of will start with the ideal and then kind of work their way down. So the ideal, let me talk about the ideal, is the agency shouldn't be regulating greenhouse gases. In our perspective, don't think that the Clean Air Act itself was intended for it to be regulated. I think you can see that with just doesn't fit well. You're right. Carbon dioxide is completely different than kind of what we would think of as the air pollutants that kind of dirty the air. And I do think that if there is greenhouse gas regulation, then Congress should speak specifically to it, and they shouldn't provide any type of broad delegation of authority to regulate greenhouse gases, but to be very specific as to what in what context they want the regulation of greenhouse gases to work, and for Congress to be, again, very specific so that you're not just creating some type of discretionary authority for the agency on how to regulate greenhouse gases. I want Congress to make these decisions. That's a lot of the book is all about. Congress should make these choices. It's up to Congress to not, if things are going to have potentially devastating effects on our lives and our economy, then let Congress make those bad decisions, not unelected bureaucrats. So that was kind of the main recommendation on greenhouse gases. But there are other considerations as well. Like we were talking about Section 202, dealing with motor vehicles. And that's the section that has the endangerment finding. And the way the court interpreted...
Can you briefly say what the endangerment finding is?
Is the product, so basically EPA, if they determine that greenhouse or whatever the pollutant might be, but in this case, the greenhouse gas emissions may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare, then the agency shall regulate those pollutants. That's the 202A1 language. And the reason why the endangerment finding is so important is because that's kind of the extent of it. The decision whether to regulate comes down to whether or not you think it may reasonably be anticipated to pose, may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. That's a very low standard. So that gets into that precaution principle idea I have. It also is an example where in making that decision, you notice I didn't say anything about the agency consider whether or not it even makes sense from a harm perspective. Does it would regulating actually create more harm than good? What would it hurt low-income communities? Would it hurt drive up prices? Would it, you know, so that was something then in Massachusetts EPA case, you know, the agency did not want to regulate greenhouse gases back in the day. And ultimately the court kind of made it a test. Like, you have to go through this endangerment analysis, and if you find an endangerous public health welfare, then you have to regulate the greenhouse gases. If you don't, then you have to explain why. So kind of a big recommendation is, look, I think whenever an agency, any agency, but especially EPA, is deciding whether or not regulation makes sense, of course they should consider the science and have the best available science to inform them. But we don't make these decisions in a vacuum. These decisions about whether to regulate affect so many other aspects of our lives. Like,
this is a distinction Roger Pilkey has made pretty effectively, I think, where he has said it's very important to understand the distinction about between what science can tell you, which is descriptive, and the actual cost and benefit of doing something with the policy decision. So science gives you information, but it doesn't tell you, you know, science can't tell you that the optimal level of something is X or Y, because you have to decide the comparative value of different costs and benefits as a policy matter.
Well,
that distinction sometimes gets, like, I think about COVID, you know, there were a lot of things that we lived through where it's like, there was no way this was cost justified, but we were told, you know, follow the science and things like that. You know, it seems to me that there's a bigger picture category error, both with policymakers and I think with many members of the public.
This is an issue very close to my heart and the heart of some of us here at CEI. I've written about for a while, is what I consider the conflating of science and policy, is that kind of trying to make there's an effort to try to make policy choices look as if there's some type of, pretend as if there's an objective scientific answer to a particular policy question, as if it's science. Or if you don't agree with a particular policy choice, it means you don't agree with the science. No, the science answers the science. It answers the objective questions. And then that's all it does. And it shouldn't go beyond that. And the policy choices are that the policymakers need to use the science to inform them. And then it's up to them to make choices regarding how to best address whatever issue it might be, taking into account the science. Now, I will say the book does talk a little bit about different, our first chapter is actually about science.
It's not a little bit, it's a long chapter, and it's got a lot of detailed chapter. Recommendations on how to improve science.
I will say that one of the, it's important is that science, so there's a science advisory board at the EPA, there's something called the CASAC, which deals with Clean Air Science Advisory Committee. Statutorily required, but there are just times when these advisory boards get into issues that have absolutely nothing to do with science. Like when I remember, I don't know if it was SAB or CASAC. No, it wouldn't be CASAC. It would have been SAB, where they're writing about things regarding the Waters of the United States issue and the Clean Water Act. And I remember this where they're basically, at what I would say, almost making legal arguments, certainly policy arguments. And I'm like, you know, you're not the legal advisory board, you're the science advisory board. And it's just this stay in your lane, figure out the science. There's plenty for you to do there. And it's just important. And the reason why this is an even bigger issue, even this book, is that for folks that would like to see, may not agree with certain policy choices as it relates to climate issues. If you disagree on certain climate policy choices, you're then, again, labeled as a denier or whatever other name, bad name they want to call you, because you don't agree with their policy or their ideology. And that doesn't lead to constructive dialogue or good solutions to problems.
Yeah, I think that has sort of a stultifying effect. I mean, it's supposed to. The other thing is, you know, the politicization of science and scientific research. This is something I think that the science chapter has a lot of good recommendations on, including, you know, meta-analyses, looking at the scientific research that you're using and seeing if you look at stuff over time, if you're finding what's called p-value doping, where the p-values is, you know, whether something, a correlation is statistically significant. In other words, where there's a real connection there, or whether it's just kind of random chance. And, you know, researchers have all kinds of ways that they can dope or fudge the numbers a little bit to make p-values seem significant. And if you've got that, then on a meta-analysis, things that should be normally distributed, like a bell curve, end up having this kind of funny-shaped bimodal distribution, to, you know, bring in the staff right. language here. If you want to expand on some of the ideas about that, or the other kind of meta-analyses that you recommend in the and that Marlow, who wrote that chapter, recommended in that opening part of the book, because that to me is some of the most interesting and most important. Because even if you get the distinction right between science and policy, if the science is skewed by political considerations or just by bad quality control, that's really destructive to these endeavors.
There are ways that Marlow kind of identifies some ideas on how you can try to identify where maybe some things are a little askew when it comes to you're finding results that you really shouldn't find or maybe should give pause. I think that the big issue here is, bigger picture, is there is simply a reproducibility problem with science, replication problems, peer review.
Which refers to whether you can run the same study again and get similar results, right?
Right. There is just a lot of cherry picking that goes on.
Do you have any particular good examples of where this skewed the process and led to some absurd result?
Well, I'll say that in the there are a lot of studies as relates in a particular matter where the agency just doesn't seem to want to pay attention to these other studies. And the PM2.5 stuff is a big issue. It's a big focus in the chapter. PM2.5 is fine, particulate matter. And it is kind of a really right up there as the big pollutant that the EPA focuses on and spends a lot of money on itself. And really, they're the big funder of the PM2.5 research. So one concern is you've got them being the big funder of all the research that they then use to then justify the regulations. And you're not getting kind of this other side. And to the extent that they do, we're not always seeing them kind of recognize that other research. Now, one of the issues also is just the lack of transparency. For the studies that are used and disseminated by the agency. And it's important for people to be able to access these underlying data and models to get an idea of whether or not there's the legitimacy of the studies that are being used. I think that's, you know, President Obama in, I think, 2009, 2008, maybe 2008, issued a scientific memorandum, and the big theme was, you know, the importance of having faith in the science and the integrity of science. Well, you can't have faith in the science unless people can actually review how you got to your decisions. Too much of the EPA science and a lot of the work that they do is kind of a trust us mentality. Trust us, you know, we don't trust you. That's kind of the nature of our system of government. We don't simply just trust people blindly and without question. you're implementing the laws, and it's important for people to be able to figure out whether or not you're implementing them consistent with what Congress intended, but also in a way that it actually reflects the best available science.
With I want to make sure we cover some stuff about water too, because that's another big part of the book. And Clean Water Act comes a little bit after the Clean Air Act, and one of my friends likes to joke that you could definitely tell that congressional staffers were smoking a fair bit of dope when they wrote the Clean Air Act, but then had moved on to harder drugs as the 70s went on and they wrote the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act has some crazy stuff in it, including you can join as a citizen to as a co-prosecutor in any criminal Clean Water Act endeavor as a matter of right. I don't know if anyone's ever tried it. I haven't ever looked, but that's just one kind of funky thing about it. And it's got listed pollutants include things like sunlight and anything that, you know, you put in the water, even if you just took it out of the water. So what are some reform ideas that you have for water? And, you know, conversely, though, it seems like water is one of the areas, unlike air, we do have some real water quality issues. I wouldn't want to go, you know, over to the Potomac and drink the water out of that.
Well, you don't drink.
I'm going to get there, but
I do down there and have a gulp every day. Yeah, I mean, there are some pretty specific issues with the Clean Water Act that are brought up, and I think that are actually, well, let's start with the first big issue, and that is what water is even regulated in the Clean Water Act, and that's where we get to the question of waters in the United States. The real statutory term is navigable waters, but and further is meant to be.
Navigable waters is defined as waters of the United States.
Yeah, and the territorial seas. The definition's kind of odd. And of course, it's taken the EPA and the Army Corps, who Army Corps also deals with this Clean Water Act issues and implementing the law, continuously try to expand what the meaning is and what waters are regulated. And they've gotten shot down multiple times by the Supreme Court for their overreach. And recently in a Supreme Court case called Sackett versus EPA, which is kind of the second Sackett case, there was a first one, the Supreme Court finally provided some clarity, and they also kind of blessed on what waters are covered. And I don't know that it's how critical it is for Congress to try to get into the Clean Water Act and define waters in the United States at this point, given the Supreme Court opinions, I think are favorable, but we certainly do talk about how they could do it. And it really is just trying to focus on not dealing with non-navigable waters, that it really should be, when we're talking about wetlands, it should be exactly what the Climate Court has said. You know, it's a type of a wetland only, look, a wetland by itself is not what a water that should be, it's water that regulated on its own. The only reason why a wetland would be covered is because it's, you can't tell the difference between where, you know, a traditional navigable water starts and ends.
Hey, you've got a marsh that abuts up to.
Right. And literally abuts.
Estuary or something like that.
And I think the key point is that you literally can't tell by the naked eye. Like, I can't tell. So it's just, that's why it's included. It's not because we a separate category of waters to protect. So we would, the idea is to kind of focus on, you know, traditional navigable waters and waters that are kind of connected to those waters, things that are navigable as well. And then if we're dealing with the wetlands that need to be adjacent, not just adjacent, which is what the court said, but actually connected, you can't tell the difference between
a surface water connection,
right?
One of the phrases that's been used.
And also, you know, the Supreme Court has said, and this, even the Biden administration rule that amended its wetlands rule, which we'll get into. I mean, you're dealing with relatively permanent waters, and it's important also to make sure that the court has said, and that means lakes, streams, whatever, like what people actually think of as waters. The problem with the WOTUS issue is there's effort to try to, for property owners, we just have no idea that something would even be regulated.
That was the Sackett case, right? It was a family that bought a plot of land, and they had like a little bit of low-lying property that occasionally, not even every year, every few years, would get a little bit flooded and wet, and you'd have a standing very large puddle basically in the backyard. And EPA said that this was covered by the Clean Water Act as a water of the United States.
I mean, it's because the property is next to this drain that's across the street or something, and then that's connected to this other thing, that then you go here and it's get to that, and this connect, and then that connects to a lake or whatever, and therefore it's adjacent water. It's just like, okay, come on.
It's a little bit like defining the toe as the hip, because the toe bone is connected to the knee bone.
Right, exactly. So, you know, I think enough of that. You know, I just should point out, it's necessarily legislative recommendation, but it is important, I think, for people to know that one of the major kind of legal principles that have been used for a while on the WOTUS issue was the significant nexus test for whether or not waters were regulated, is whether or not there's a significant nexus to with this water and that other water. And that unanimously got shut down by the Supreme Court. Yeah.
Of Anthony Kennedy, Kennedy style jurisprudence, right?
So I do think that there's some important recommendations in the water chapter as well regarding what are called Section 404, retroactive vetoes of Section 404 permits, or preemptive vetoes of these permits. So in other words, a property owner might get a duly issued permit from the Army Corps of Engineers, and then kind of after the fact, EPA comes in and uses its veto power under 404C to say, no, you can't
do that. Actually, it turns out permission was never granted properly in the
first place. Right, so that, you know, like that shouldn't happen. There's some language we
just think. It seems like a basic good government order of operations kind of problem.
Yeah, and then we think that there's, I should point out that, I don't know if I'm going on a tangent here, maybe, but with Section 404, they're called dredge and fill permits. And really, that's really just dirt moving activities. They're not, when we do a dredge and fill, we're not really talking about pollution the way people normally would think about pollution.
Right. It's not a point source of effluent from a factory where you've got, you know, disgusting chemicals being put in the water.
No, what you're having is a couple trying to build a house, or a farmer trying to plow his land. And so we're not dealing with anybody trying to, and what happens is a lot of property owners are not aware that they might even need the permit, or wouldn't, or even though they might be aware of the Clean Water Act, they would have no reason to believe that they need to actually get the permit, because it makes no sense, because you look at something that is actually dry land almost every day of the year, but it might hold water for a few days a year, and therefore it's a ephemeral water that somehow is covered under the Clean Water Act. Again, I don't think that will be, I think moving forward, I don't think the EPA and Corps will go with that anymore, but you never know. So that's one reason why it's kind of as a strategic reason, like, okay, the court has given there's a good precedent here. So, you know, is it worth going into the legislation trying to change the Clean Water Act and opening it up to even for mischief? Or, you know, there's also the other argument where you recognize EPA and Corps exactly haven't been, they've always been trying to expand their power as much as possible. So maybe they'll never really properly interpret the Sackett case. Therefore, we may need to have a legislative solution. So, yeah, it's great. I think Clean Water Act chapter written by Tony Francois is a great chapter. I very easy to read, too.
Excellent. The running here towards the end of our time, I think, but I do have a couple more quick questions for you.
Sure.
One is about citizen suits. And for people who don't do environmental law, I find that this concept is very surprising, because, you know, we don't have citizen suits for like traffic enforcement. You know, we don't say, this is an example I'm borrowing from Professor Michael Grava. He says, imagine like you have, you can just sit around and see someone run a red light, and you can go and you can, you know, just bring an action against them because you saw it happen. or that you just found it happen on like a, you know, some registry of the photos of who ran the red light. But that's basically how citizen suits work under the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, many of the other, you know, less prominent environmental statutes. And you have some ideas for reforming them. I tend to think that they have some serious constitutional problems, just because you wouldn't let people bring criminal prosecutions or civil actions for penalties against folks in other contexts. But you know, maybe if you want to talk about the recommendations you have and what you think could be done to reform the citizen suits situation.
Yeah, so these laws, these provisions, I think there are over 20 environmental statutes, actually. Kind of a private attorneys general situation. And this isn't actually in the chapter, but there are situations, no matter what people say, because I've seen them, where there's kind of a sue and settle situation, and the agency will agree to it's not just that the agency is being sued to meet a specific deadline or to do something they're required, but also I've seen agreements where
you're talking about citizen suits where you can sue the agent. There are two types, right? There's one that's right. Enforcement. And then I think what you're talking about is where there's a mandatory duty, often without sufficient funding or resources for the agency to do it. And then you can sue as an NGO and make them do it and get your attorney fees thrown in.
Yeah. And so, you know, sometimes people call those deadline suits, but the point is that sometimes there's discretionary decisions kind of baked into these agreements that have altered certain, the nature of the rules. Now, even when they don't, the problem is that if you have the deadline suit, sometimes they can be very rushed, and then you avoid some of the procedural protections that exist in the promulgation of a rule. So some of the recommendations, the citizen supervision we discussed specifically in the water chapter. It could have been discussed elsewhere as well. It's just something we tended to do. But I think the key point is kind of recognizing that the plaintiff itself should have some type of injury in law. And
the Supreme Court, Darren, has said that an aesthetic injury is sufficient, which has led Justice Thomas to ask if that doesn't mean basically everything. For instance, the Supreme Court has said that getting an accurate credit report is not something that people have standing on its own to sue about. And Justice Thomas has pointed out, well, what if they claimed an aesthetic injury from that?
Well, you know, I've been asked a lot, like, why is it so easy, at least from our perspective or my perspective, easy to get standing in the environmental context, but it's just, it seems to be more difficult for like some business or trade group.
I have a case at the Supreme Court this month about whether California's electric vehicle mandate is something that fuel manufacturers and producers can sue about. It's pretty obvious that they're injured by that, but it's a little bit.
But are they more injured than me not knowing that the, you know, whatever wolf in the Grand Canyon or wherever, some park that I'll probably never visit but might want to one day, may not be around or won't be as many? Unfortunately, those types of injuries, abstract, speculative injuries, tend to seem to work when it comes to environmental context, but something that to me is far more direct, like in what you just said, doesn't always seem to work. So that's a real problem. I think a lot of the challenges also deal with like paperwork violations and things like that. They're just these supervision, at least in the Clean Water Act context, which makes no sense. So there's more details as well in the book on trying to fix these problems because.
There are dysfunctionality, it sounds like.
I think the Corps and the EPA do plenty of enough to create havoc.
As someone who's represented them before, I can say that, yes, that is the case. All right, so you also have some recommendations about the IRA, and I want to make sure you get a chance to talk about those, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, and ways in which that should be changed.
Yeah, this will be really quick. Get rid of those IRA provisions that deal with anything to do with energy, pretty much all the, I'll put air quotes, green subsidies. Now the EPA has, now this is an EPA book, so it has several different IRA programs as well. And we get rid of every one of them. Many of the provisions in the IRA dealing with the EPA try to get cute by trying to expressly authorize the regulation of greenhouse gas. By for every provision, then at the, it will say like spend money for X, Y, and Z, and then it'll say greenhouse gases are the air pollutants, blah, 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 whatever.
Yeah, there are a couple of fast ones that they try to pull there, I think.
Those are spending programs, not by itself giving regulatory authority, although it does provide, arguably can provide help for anybody making
a case. One interesting thing that does come up is, I'm sure you're aware, there are a number of state attempts to basically expropriate the American energy industry by trying to retroactively tax them for carbon dioxide emissions, or to say that they somehow deceived the public and that we wouldn't have filled up our cars if we had known just how terrible things were. And one of the core arguments against that is that, look, the Clean Air Act takes the field here, and that's the whole regulatory regime for the entire country. And so you can't come in over the top with these other things and say, we're regulating this in this other way or retroactively or whatever. There is, I think, some concern that if you're undoing those kind of provisions, you might be, and I think this is a misplaced concern, but I do think it requires being clear if you're a lawmaker or being clear if you're a regulator, that what's happening here is not opening the door to states to go even further and do crazy climate stuff on their own.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's a good point. And I think that's something that, to the extent that that's an issue, needs to be thought through. I also, the argument that somehow we wouldn't have filled up our gas tank, but we're filling up our gas tank right now. And we'll continue to. I mean, just the idea of these retroactive laws should be concerning to anybody, for any industry. And I'm sure the Federal Society is doing or has done events on these laws, and we certainly need to. They're concerning, very concerning. There's a lot of, President Trump just had an executive order on some of the state overreach. I'm not sure what that will lead to ultimately, but that's something that's certainly on the radar screen of the administration. Every way you look at it on the climate stuff, it's state, federal, global, it's regulation, it's spending, it's, think about an appliance issue. It's federal regulations to try to restrict appliances. It's spending money, giving it to states or local communities to establish building codes to make it more difficult or to have building codes that you won't be able to connect to the natural gas appliances. It's just kind of the same thing as better.
Right. Which the Ninth Circuit said you can't do, right?
Right, so it's the same thing with the cars, as you know better than I do.
Very similar arguments there.
You have multiple agencies at the federal level. And I would just stress, because we're talking about the IRA, I believe that certain politicians recognize that people really don't care about spending very much, and that if you want to achieve your objectives, you just spend, and you can use that to achieve kind of very radical changes in the country. And that, I think in the past, you would say, well, we can't get the spending through, so we'll use a regulatory process to try to achieve it. I think things almost have flipped, where we're going to spend and regulations will almost be our backup plan.
So, I think that is an interesting, and I think you're correct that's one of the few areas where Congress does seem to be able to come together and actually do something. But you can't, throwing money at problems is not a substitute for smart standards and actual, law. Well, we're here, I think we're right at the end of our time. to close out, what are the next steps for the project, and where can people find more information on it?
Well, they can find more information at CEI.org. There's kind of a page for the project, and also you can get a copy of the book, and you know, we have hard copies too.
I got to get one. I've just got to
get one. And so, we're going to be working on this issue for a long time. It's not just release the book and then go home. It's release the book, and this is just the start of the process. We want to turn the ideas, and there are many specific ideas, and it would be impossible to really to go through it in a podcast and actually have people listen to it. So we're trying to turn these ideas into legislation, and we consider this to be a big fight, and we hope that people would join us in this fight to modernize and reform the EPA.
Well, thank you, Darren, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this podcast. I hope you all get the book in hard copy or PDF and read it, because it's a very interesting piece of work and analysis. So thanks again.
Well, thank you both for sharing your time and expertise with us today. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in.
Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.